From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Dan Richards. In the world right now, there are over 25 million people living as refugees. Some are trying to escape violence, like in Ukraine. Others are fleeing from poverty, like in Venezuela. It's a human tragedy, and we don't seem to have a good plan to solve it. Part of the reason for this is because the act of accepting refugees brings with it fraught politics in much of the world. And in the US at least, we're not just talking about the political fringes stoking fear and resentment of outsiders. There's also a widespread belief that large amounts of immigration can diminish the prospects of native-born people, that there are serious trade-offs when it comes to opening our doors to more immigrants. It's a belief that's helping to keep millions of people from finding safety and security around the world. It's also, according to Watson economist Danny Bahar, simply not true.
Immigrants and refugees tend to create businesses at higher rates than natives, tend to integrate into the labor force often at higher rates, subsequently create many more jobs than natives. And these are all facts, it's not an opinion.
And as he sees it, changing this narrative matters not just for immigrants and refugees, but for all of us.
Without immigrants, America is not going to be able to remain the strongest or the most important or the richest or the most competitive nation on earth.
On this episode, Danny Bahar on what the data actually reveal about the benefits of immigration and why it's more important than ever that we set the record straight. Before Danny ever started researching the economics of immigration, he, like so many people, was already on some level aware of its power.
Immigration has been very central to my family. My grandparents were Holocaust survivors and were refugees. My grandmother was born in today's Poland. My grandfather was born in today the Republic of Northern Macedonia, back then Yugoslavia. Most of their families were murdered by the Nazis and they survived and they ended up in Venezuela because it was kind of the only country that let them in.
And that's because
Venezuela at the time was one of the countries of the Americas, one of the few ones that really had an open door policy. It was kind of part of their development strategy to bring in immigrants and also refugees to develop the country.
Danny was raised in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. But as he got older, he decided to try calling a new place home.
I developed a very deep interest and connection to Israel, and I decided to immigrate to Israel after college. I lived for a few years, and then I decided to immigrate again to the U.S. to continue my studies, and that's where I got a PhD. And yeah, I think it's hard to think that maybe my own personal history didn't really lead me into studying all these topics. Of course, it played a big role.
Danny's research has explored the economic impact of different types of immigration around the world. Immigration of people with advanced degrees, of refugees with no degrees, immigration into rich countries, immigration into developing countries. And while the exact effects, of course, vary depending on context, Danny's research and that of many others has started to show that, by and large, the long-term economic impacts of immigration on a country or community are beneficial. And yet,
there is a big discrepancy between these findings and kind of the public perception.
Before we get into that discrepancy and why it exists, let's look at why, according to Danny, immigrants are so very good for a country's economy. And actually, just before we get to that, let's clarify one thing. When we talk about immigrants in this episode, we're referring to both people who move to another country by choice and to people who do so out of economic or physical necessity. That latter group are what we call refugees, but they fit under the broader category of immigrants as well. Okay, so let's get into it. There are a bunch of different ways that immigration helps a host country's economy. Some might be obvious, others not so much. To start, immigrants create businesses at higher rates than native-born people.
A third of all the Fortune 500 companies were founded by immigrants. 20 or 30% of all patents in the US are being patented by either immigrants or children of immigrants.
This is when people might point to Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Sergey Brin, Steve Jobs. They are all tech entrepreneurs and are either all the children of immigrants or immigrants themselves. But this isn't just a phenomenon in the tech industry and not just a phenomenon in Fortune 500 companies.
There's so many examples of that. My favorite is the sriracha sauce that we serve in restaurants and homes. I don't know if you know the story. So the famous one, the brand being Hue Fong, was founded by a refugee, a Vietnamese refugee who arrived to California in the late 70s. And Hue Fong was the name of the vessel that brought him. And, you know, that firm not only creates delicious sauce, but also creates jobs and value to the economy.
You might be wondering, why do immigrants and children of immigrants have this disproportionate level of entrepreneurialism? Well, it's hard to say for certain, but here's what Danny suggests.
I'm going to give you an answer, but let me tell you why the answer might not be fully rigorous. Just because sometimes there are things that are hard to measure. Culture, for lack of a better word, or like behavior, those things are hard to measure. Or like, what are we thinking the whole day? Like if immigrants have different attitudes than natives, those are hard to measure. However, one thing that I do believe that is kind of a wide accepted answer to your question is the risk-taking approach that immigrants usually have, which is the same approach that an entrepreneur must have. So like immigrants tend to be much more tolerant of risk. That's what economists call kind of a self-selection thing, right? Because the act of migrating itself is a very risky act. People sometimes undermine how difficult it is to migrate. Even if it's planned, you're moving to a place, often with a different language. You don't really have as big of a network, if at all, as you used to have in your previous country. The act of migrating is an act of risk-taking because to some extent you are kind of jumping into a pool and not knowing exactly what's expecting for you.
A higher risk tolerance, an ability to handle uncertainty, ambition, these are all traits that are essential to people who start businesses. And they're not just helpful for entrepreneurs.
So I think that those characteristics are very typical on people who excel in their profession, even as employees, trying to think out of the box, trying to move up the ladder.
One example of this from colleagues of Danny's.
There's some studies out there by Rana Bramitsky and Leah Bustan, who are at Stanford and Princeton, respectively. And they just have a new book called The Promised Land, in which they're actually looking at immigration historically in the U.S. since the 1800s. And one of their findings in one of the recent papers, and I'm sure it's kind of something that you will also see in the book, is that the American dream, quote unquote, is much more alive among immigrants than Americans. Like the immigrants, they tend to go up in this occupational ladder much faster than the average American. And it's not because they're better, it's not because they're more prepared. It's probably because of this risk-taking attitude that it's very salient on immigrants.
It's relatively easy to make the case that if immigrants tend to start more businesses, that will be good for the economy. Many Americans across the political spectrum can agree on that. The same is true of immigrants with advanced educational degrees who are able to fill roles that U.S. firms desperately need. And there have actually been bipartisan efforts to allow for more immigration of highly educated, quote, high-skilled workers into the United States. But what about immigrants who don't start businesses and who don't have advanced degrees? What some people might call, quote, low-skilled workers, but who Danny refers to as fundamental workers. This is where you get into more contentious debates around immigration.
When it comes to fundamental workers, or like people without college degrees or even less, I think the perception is much more alive that we don't want them, quote unquote.
Part of the reason for this is because many people have a model in their mind that goes something like this. More immigrants into a country means more people seeking low-paying jobs in that country, which leads to more competition with native-born people for those jobs, which leads to even lower wages. In other words,
supply and demand.
The supply of workers goes up, the price of labor, aka wages, goes down. People with this model in their head might say that out of a desire to help people fleeing places like Ukraine or Afghanistan and bringing them to the US, we're diminishing job prospects for native-born people. But according to Danny,
empirically, that's hardly the evidence we see.
As he explains, when it comes to immigration and labor markets, the concept of supply and demand is usually understood way too simplistically.
And here I usually rely on research by Giovanni Perri, who's a professor at UC Davis. And he has a very beautiful study in Denmark, where he's really looking at what happens with the inflow of tens of thousands of more of refugees coming from different countries, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and Syria, etc. And about 70% of them don't have a college degree. So this is the population that the question is about. And what you find in that study is that when these people come into the economy, they will take jobs that natives are maybe not so willing to take, or they actually want to move away from, and, you know, but the dynamics of the market are such that they're kind of stuck there. And what you end up seeing is that the locals actually move towards better jobs once the immigrants come.
One theoretical example of this:
you are in California and you are a farmer picking, you know, fruits in the camps. And then, you know, you have immigrants coming from Mexico who are also willing to do the job. Well, maybe that allows the American worker in this case to, you know, take more of a managing role. Also, the American worker will typically have comparative advantage in some things, such as the language or such as maybe knowing the market more closely. So it kind of even creates a bit of a more efficient market, quote unquote, in very economics terms, in which, you know, every person will be focusing on what their comparative advantage is, and that makes everybody better off.
Another reason it makes everyone better off is that no matter what jobs people are filling,
immigrants also eat and also wear clothes, and also, you know, go and buy things, and they also consume. So they also increase demand for workers.
In other words,
jobs are not like an apple, that we only have one, and either you eat it or not. I mean, it's the pie grows, and there's no reason to think that the pie is not going to grow when you bring more people.
A casual supply and demand analysis does not take this into account.
The model assumes that, you know, one unit of work is the same, whether it's you or me, and that you and me are completely substitutes. And the truth is that I'm an immigrant, but you're very good at doing podcasts. And if I were, you know, I can't take your job.
Right.
You know, I'm going to be very bad at it. You're much better at it. And we're not competing with each other. On the contrary, I want to argue, this is not going to be very humble, but the fact that I'm here as an immigrant, I'm actually helping you have another episode.
Right.
And that helps you in your job. Right? So we are complements. We're not substitutes. So just assuming that, you know, an immigrant and a native, or two immigrants or two natives, are just two units of labor that are like fighting with each other for one job is a very, very simplistic view of the world. And that view, unfortunately, has really taken on a lot of the perception, definitely sometimes among politicians, but also among people. So, you know, it is our job to come and say, you know, that might be the model, but the model is very simplistic. When you actually look at the data, that's not what's happening.
Which is all to say,
the idea that we don't need any immigrants who are fundamental workers is just kind of a contradiction with how America wants its economy to be.
Danny and other scholars are working to show that immigration offers host countries tremendous opportunities for growth and prosperity. But Danny's research doesn't end there, because as he and others have found, in order for host countries to fully realize the potential benefits of immigration, they need to enact certain policies. Without them, all the benefits we've been discussing can be stifled. What are those policies? There's one particular case study Danny used to explain them to me, a case study that is, unfortunately, very close to Danny's heart. Venezuela. In the early 2010s, a series of overlapping economic and political crises hit the country. Government efforts to solve the situation often ended up making things worse, leading to widespread shortages of food and medicine, to hyperinflation, and to skyrocketing unemployment. This all led to a massive exodus out of the country. For many people, that meant crossing the border into Colombia. When Danny first learned of this crisis, he did something kind of unusual for an academic economist.
It probably sounded crazy at the time, but I literally decided to travel and go to the border and see by myself what was happening.
He didn't have a plan or a research grant. Danny just went.
I thought it was important to go and understand.
If part of the draw was personal, it was also academic. You see, Colombia did not have policies in place at the time to handle a refugee crisis of this size. Few countries do. So their response to this crisis represented a unique opportunity to analyze the effect of immigration policies in real time.
So they found themselves really trying to think how to design these policies. And, you know, I had the fortune of being involved from an academic side and trying to understand the effectiveness of these policies.
His work, combined with research from economists exploring similar issues around the world, has helped confirm some of the policies that are essential for making immigration the win-win enterprise it has the potential to be. The first policy?
Let them work.
As in, legally work.
Don't keep people away from the labor markets, because they are going to work anyway, and they're going to work in the black market. You know, in areas where you have a lot of your vulnerable population also working.
Once people are living in your country, there's no good reason to keep them from legally working.
From a fiscal point of view, like, why would you want them to work in a black market and not pay income tax?
Once people are working in a stable, legal way, they can start to contribute in all those ways Danny and other researchers have enumerated. They start businesses, hire people, work in fundamental jobs, support other businesses as consumers. They pay taxes. This is something the Colombian government figured out pretty quickly.
Even to those who actually came in undocumented, you know, they put forward a huge amnesty project to give them a visa to everybody with the right to work and the right to education and the right to health, etc. And, you know, we're doing a lot of studies there to really evaluate that. And so far, we've found that, you know, that didn't have any negative effects on the local labor markets, which is the very short-term thing that you can look at. And we're working very hard with the Colombian government and thinking about what's the best way to integrate people in the labor markets. I mean, given the right work doesn't mean that people are going to find a job, because finding a job is hard, but you still have to, you know, give them the chance to do that.
This might seem obvious if you're a country accepting large numbers of immigrants and refugees, but this policy doesn't always get put into practice.
In the case of Turkey, with millions of Syrian refugees, it took Turkey about, I'm simplifying the story here a little bit, but it took Turkey about 5 years since they started arriving to actually give them a job permit. By then, it was too late. I mean, everybody was maybe working in the informal sector, which is already big, you know, to begin with. In many developing countries, the informal sector is very large, so it does draw a lot of people. And, you know, you lost like a lot of time on trying to get people to integrate. So you really want people to integrate as much as you can. There's no downsides to that.
Allowing for legal work permits is only part of the solution.
You also want to give people enough time so that they have a long-term horizon. Colombia gave to Venezuelans a 2-year visa originally, and now they're giving them a 10-year visa, because I think they understood that the importance of a long-term perspective.
This is important not just for immigrants themselves, who benefit from being able to make long-term plans and feel invested in their new community. It's also important for the people who might potentially employ them.
Even if you have a super bright doctor engineer that you want to hire, you know, you might think twice if you want to hire somebody that can only work for 2 years or for a year or two, right? So without giving them enough of an horizon for them to settle and for them to invest in themselves and for the firm to invest in their workers, you're not off to a good start.
It turns out that even for those risk-taking, proactive future entrepreneurs we discussed earlier, this type of stability still is very helpful.
We have a study going on also in Colombia in which we find that after the undocumented workers got visas that allow them, gave them a longer horizon, they started, you know, registering new firms in the country. So they became entrepreneurs at much higher rates, even by a factor of 10, which is a huge effect.
Danny isn't just studying the effects of these policies in Colombia. He's actually helping to shape them.
I've been, you know, putting forward white papers and policy papers to hopefully and humbly to try to inform or maybe give some ideas to policymakers on a good path forward. You know, my grandparents were welcomed by Venezuelans as refugees when nobody else wanted them. So, you know, it of course is very moving to me that I'm at a very, 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 very small scale. It's now me really trying to help my countrymates, you know, from my corner as a researcher, but still like trying to pay back the opening they gave to my family.
What Danny's finding in Colombia
can easily be replicated to other areas like Poland with the Ukrainians or Moldova or other countries in Latin America, like experiencing large inflows.
So if the evidence supporting these types of policies is overwhelming, why aren't these policies being enacted everywhere?
And that's a big enigma, or maybe a big reason to blame us economists.
Now, you can't blame it all on economists and policymakers for not selling it well enough. And that's because immigration is not just another policy problem. It's an emotionally charged issue in the US and around the world. And in this moment of rising ethno-nationalism in countries ranging from the United States to India, more and more people are being taught to think that immigrants are a threat to their financial future and maybe also to their way of life. It's a fear that's been stoked and sometimes ignited in the first place by politicians and activists who see an upside in turning citizens against some imaginary outsider. It's come to play a key role in so many toxic political movements today. And it, of course, can't just be solved with data proving otherwise. But it probably can't be solved without good data either.
That's part of what I try, you know, from my corner to answer. But you know, I think it's a huge challenge. There's many other challenges in this country. But that's, I think, one of the biggest ones, to understand the reality of it and not to let those demagoguery take center stage in our thought and in our planning.
If we aren't able to do that soon, it'll be bad not just for people seeking safety and opportunity in new countries around the world. It'll be bad for all of us and the countries we all call home.
Without immigrants, America is not going to be able to remain the strongest or the most important or the richest or the most competitive nation on earth. It made it so far thanks to immigrants, and the damage that this very toxic conversation that happened over the past presidency, and some of that we're still seeing it like in politics, is going to be detrimental to the American economy over the next decades in ways that are not going to be fixed by anything else. The missing immigrants, missing entrepreneurs, missing innovators, missing fundamental workers that are helping the innovators and entrepreneurs, if they don't come to America, they're going to go somewhere else. So if the long-term strategy of this country is to remain the country that Americans are so proud of being the leader of the free world and being the strongest economy in the world and the leading economy in the world, those things can vanish very easily, you know, the more this country closes its door to immigration.
It's an economic, political, cultural, and historical project to create a widespread understanding that immigration is far from being something we should fear. It's a national resource and an opportunity to embrace.
Once we understand that, I think the rest is going to be very easy to fix.
This episode was produced by me, Dan Richards, and Kate Dario. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. You can learn more about Trending Globally and all of Watson's podcasts on our website. We'll put a link in the show notes. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Trending Globally. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Thanks.